Hi, my name is John Harrison, and I'm the new Native American Studies bibliographer for the library. You didn't come to hear me, but I was asked to introduce the event and explain how it all came together. In response to a request for a Native American Studies monograph, yes, we do accept requests for new publications to be added to the library, and we're happy to receive those. I had the good fortune to end up talking with Mindy Morgan, the acting director of the MSU American Indian Studies program this year. She told me that several AISP faculty had published or were in the process of publishing books, and was it possible to reserve a room in the library for a special event honoring those faculty members, and also to honor a visiting faculty member from the University of Arizona who was coming as well. Normally, we have a faculty publication recognition event at the end of the spring semester, which I hopefully will see all of you again. The president will be there and various other dignitaries. But I did promise to investigate. I talked with Michael Rodriguez, who's the coordinator for our the Michigan Writers Series. And since he had just mentioned to us that he was interested in featuring MSU faculty members this year, I said, you know, I bet he'll say yes. Well, I went around and got everybody's approval, and so here I am. On behalf of the MSU Libraries Computing and Technology, and in coordination with the MSU American Indian Studies Program, I officially welcome all of you for today's Michigan Writer Series Campus Authors Panel Discussion. Featured panelists include Susan Lobo, a visiting scholar from the American Indian Studies Program at the University of Arizona. And if you picked up these flyers at the front, you'll know all of their publications, but I'll repeat them anyway. She's the author of Sweet Smell of Home, The Life and Art of Leonard F. Chana, as well as co-editor of the upcoming third edition of Native American Voices. Did I see it in print?
Yes.
It is in print. It's already come out. All the rest of the panelists today are MSU faculty members. Heather A. Howard, assistant professor of anthropology and co-editor of Keeping the Campfires Going, Native Women's Activism in Urban Communities. Susan Applegate Krause, associate professor of anthropology and director of the American Indian Studies Program, and also co-editor of Keeping the Campfires Going, Native Women's Activism in Urban Communities. Kimberly A. Lee, assistant professor in the Writing, Rhetoric, and American Cultures Department and author of I Do Not Apologize for the Length of This Letter, the Marie Sandoz Letters on Native American Rights, 1940 to 1965. We also had hoped that two other speakers would be here, or at least another speaker. Susan Sleeper Smith was not able to come. She's a professor of history and editor of Rethinking the Fur Trade, Cultures of Exchange in the Atlantic World, and Contesting Knowledge, Museums and Indigenous Perspectives. So I just wanted to mention her, but I have a feeling that her colleagues will probably mention her activities as well. Before I sit down, and I'll sit down very soon, I want to mention that the MSU Libraries has ordered copies of all of the publications that your panelists have written today. And like I said before, those of you who are related to the American Indian Studies program, feel free to contact me later on, and I'll be happy to investigate acquiring any other publications that you think would be good for your own research or for those of your students. And let me know if there's anything else that I can do for you. I was also asked to mention that another program that's coming up, Borges and MSU. I don't know if you've seen the flyers. Hopefully you have, but the starting time and location has been changed. Instead of being in the International Center, it will be here in the library on October 15th, and it will start at 4:30. And with that, I'll turn it over.
I'm going to steal the top copy.
Sure.
Thank you so much for that introduction.
And thanks to everyone here at the library for allowing us to come and use this space. Thanks to all of you for coming out on this beautiful fall afternoon. And thanks as well to the indigenous people whose homelands we are on, the Ojibwe people, Potawatomi people, Odawa people. We do this traditionally at American Indian events. We acknowledge and give respect to the people whose homelands we are borrowing for this event this afternoon. Again, my name is Susan Applegate Krause, and I'm the director of American Indian Studies sometimes. Mindy Morgan is the director sometimes. And we're kind of playing, what do you call it, like tag teaming these days to make sure things get covered. So what we would like to do this afternoon is talk about the process of publishing. Most of our books are here, so you can look at those books, and I know that we'll have time afterward to talk with you individually about books, but we want to talk about sort of how they got to be books. So this is the order that we're going to do. I'm going to pretend I'm Mindy for a very brief moment and talk a little bit about her book. Then I'm going to go back to being myself and talk a little bit about a book that's not here today, and we'll talk about why, but which has been published. And then we're going to turn it over to Kim Lee, then to Heather Howard, and then to Susan Lobo. And we'll each talk for a little bit and then open it up for questions. We do have food also, so we'll go through this relatively quickly so that we can all get to the food too. So let me begin. Mindy has this lovely book called The Bearer of This Letter, which just came out from University of Nebraska Press, and it is actually for sale back at the book table. And she asked me to talk a little bit about the fact that this is, in some ways, a book that is esoteric. It focuses on one community, specifically the Fort Belknap Reservation in Montana. And at that reservation, it talks about one language revitalization project. But as she was beginning to turn to making this into a book, this research into a book, she had some very good conversations with Gary Dunham, who was at that time the editor at University of Nebraska Press. And he encouraged her to broaden that perspective so that it was not just this single focus, but to think about the larger implications of this language revitalization program and link it to other language revitalization programs, as well as linking it to federal Indian policy. And she was very pleased with that suggestion, and when she told me this, I said, wow, that's really a suggestion that probably most of us could use. As we do our research, we tend to get very focused on one thing. And when you bring that to publication, you want it to have a bigger context, a broader appeal. You want it to sell to more people. You want people to be able to use it in multiple ways. So she said that was the most valuable suggestion that she got, and she knows that it made it a better book. So that's my comment from Mindy. And if you have questions afterward, I'll try to answer them as Mindy, but I won't do as good a job as she would have. So let me trade places here and talk to you as Susan Applegate Krause. I have a book called North American Indians in the Great War, which is about American Indian soldiers in the First World War. It came out in hardback from University of Nebraska Press 2 years ago in 2007, and we had a lovely book party for that. It has also just come out in paperback, and I understand that they shipped the paperback copies to Missouri instead of Michigan. So thank you to the bookstore for trying. We can't always get what we want, but it is out in paperback, and I'm very grateful for that, and I'll talk about why I'm especially grateful that it came out in paperback in just a moment. This was a long process for me to get this book published, probably more than 10 years from the initial research to publication. 30 years since I first laid eyes on some of the material that's in the book. Now you know sort of how old I am because I was an undergraduate at the time. But I did not think about this portion of this particular collection of materials as a book for a very long time. Then I finally began to realize that it was very rich and that I should do something with it and that I should really tell this story of American Indians in World War I. Now, the collection that this is based on is at the Mathers Museum at Indiana University. So, of course, as I was getting the manuscript ready, I thought, well, of course, I'll offer it to Indiana University Press. So I did, and they were very anxious to get it. They were happy and excited about it, and then they turned it down. I was mortified. And I thought, how could they possibly reject this book that has to do with a collection at the university? But indeed, they did. It was reviewed by military historians, which is not inappropriate for this book because it is about Indian soldiers in World War I, but it maybe wasn't the best choice. So I'll tell you what I did. I did get comments from both the outside reviewers, and I looked at those comments. I looked at every single one. I matched it to the text. I made all the editorial corrections that one of the reviewers suggested because they helped to clarify things. I took into consideration many of the sort of larger questions and comments that they had. I did not incorporate everything, but I did look at everything and took it very seriously. And I used those comments to strengthen the book. And that was a very important part of this process for me. Then what I did was have one of my colleagues read it, who happens to be Fred Roberts, for those of you who know Dr. Roberts, really a fabulous colleague. He said that he would read it. I thought it was a very generous thing for him to do. He read it, and he also gave me extensive comments. And it was then that I realized I did not write the book that Fred wanted me to write, and I wasn't going to write the book that Fred wanted me to write. But because I had not made clear to him what the book was that I was writing, that I had to fix that. So I used almost none of his suggestions except to go back and rewrite and think about, okay, how do I make this clear to the reader what this book is about? And the book is really about giving voice to these Indian soldiers. It's not my story. It's not the story of the guy who collected this stuff. It's those voices. So I was really happy because then when I took it to University of Nebraska Press, which, by the way, is much more prestigious in American Indian Studies than Indiana Press is, when I took it to Nebraska, they gave me an advance contract right away. And it was really wonderful. Then it went through some editorial process. I got more comments from outside reviewers, which were very helpful. And all of those made it a better book. Then I'm all set. I think I'm ready to go. I have the manuscript. And Gary Dunham, who was the editor, sent me an email and said, "What if we rearranged it?" And I thought, why? And then he laid out a very good argument for rearranging it so that those voices that I was so concerned about would appear immediately. And instead, you know, I had, like a good academic, done all this introductory material. And so you didn't get the story until, you know, 25 pages into the book. And he said, let's move them to the front. So, and he's had several suggestions like that, and again, I took them very seriously. I did rearranging. I did not use all of his suggestions. And when I sent it back, I said, this is what I've done, and this is why I've done it. And he sent it back, and he said, this is exactly what we need. So it went to press. Now, this took a long time. Publishing takes a long time, as I'm sure everyone will talk about. But it was really worth it, because it is a much better book. There were problems along the way, and one of the main problems is that during the time that I was doing this, Gary Dunham was leaving University of Nebraska Press. So I'm pretty sure that over the course of this process, I talked to or had email conversation with 14 different people in the editorial department of the press. And after a while, that got pretty tiresome. I don't think that that's usual, and maybe other people will speak to that. It was annoying after a while, but, you know, you just have to be persistent, conscientious, courteous. If somebody's asking you the same question that somebody else asked you, you just send them the same email and say, talk to your colleagues. So that was the biggest problem, and I don't think that's really a problem. One of the things that I really wanted from the very beginning was to make sure that this book came out in paperback. The hardback cost $45. The paperback I knew would be cheaper. And one of the things that I wanted to happen was for this book to be available for the families of the Indian soldiers whose stories are in this book. And at $45, I was pretty sure there would be a lot of people who did not want to buy the book. So I started talking about the paperback in the very first conversation that I had with the press. It was on my radar, it was in my contract, that as soon as they sold out the hardback edition, they would put it into paperback. Well, I kept reminding them of that, and last year I was at the American Anthropological Association meetings, and they did not have my book. Maybe this is a pattern. But they didn't have it, and the reason was because it's in military history. But there's a new editor at Nebraska, and so I went to him and I said, you don't have my book. And he said, it's because it's military history. And I said, I'm an anthropologist. And he went, huh, you're right. He was very embarrassed, and I thought, oh, good, I can make guilt work for me. And I said, I think all the copies are sold, right? And he said, I think they are too. And I said, then we need the paperback. And, oh, it was perfect timing. I mean, you love this. So he agreed. The paperback is out. It's just that it's in Missouri instead of Michigan. And it will make it much more accessible to lots of families. I'm hoping that next summer on the powwow circuit, I see the book in paperback. The Smithsonian Museum of the American Indian Museum only carries paperbacks, so they haven't had this book. And now I'm hoping that they will. So you got to keep pushing. You got to be consistent. You got to persevere. And my last word is to remind you that don't lose sight of your goal, which is to take that book and hold it in your hand. Thank you. Let me turn this over at this point to number three, Kimberly Lee.
Hello, everyone.
And you can stand.
You think I should?
Yeah.
All right. Oops. I have to trade waters. I'm Dr. Kimberly Lee. I work in the Writing, Rhetoric, and American Cultures Department here at MSU. This is my book. I do not apologize for the length of this letter, which I should say I do not apologize for the length of this title. It's quite a long one, I have to say. But the book itself grew out of my dissertation that I wrote while I was a PhD student at University of Nebraska Lincoln. And one of the things that struck me about doing this project was that I actually got to work in the archives as a research assistant while I wrote my dissertation. So I was actually immersed in Sandozia the whole time I worked on my PhD there in Lincoln. The original idea for my dissertation was a far cry from what I came up with in the end, but I have Malia Powell to thank for sending me in the right direction, and Dr. John Wonder, who told me that my original idea was really pretty bad. So I was heartbroken for about 5 minutes, then I realized he was right. And he subsequently is the editor for the Great Plains series at Texas Tech Press, which is where the book actually ended up. It's a collection of edited letters that Nebraska author Mari Sandoz wrote on behalf of the tribes in the Northern Plains during the termination and relocation years of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Sandoz is widely published. She had 20 books before her death in 1966 and several introductions to other books that she wrote. And I find her writing very interesting and intriguing. She always thought of herself as a historian, but I see her more as a biographer of the Great Plains. What can I tell you about the process? This was interesting because originally I submitted my manuscript to the University of Nebraska, which, of course, is where all of this archival work began. And they kept the manuscript for a year and then sent me an email and said, thanks, but no thanks, literally. And so I thought, well, that's it. You know, nobody, this is a dissertation. Nobody wants to read this. And I sort of gave up. And about 2 months later, I happened to be at a conference and someone said, well, whatever happened to the prediction that University of Nebraska would publish your dissertation? I said, well, it went down in flames. And then the person said, well, you ought to try Texas Tech Press. They have a new Plains series, History of the Plains series that they're launching, and they might be interested in it. So I sent an email casually to Judith Keeling, who's the editor there. And I must say, working with women editors has been a joy for me. And she emailed right away and said, please, please send it to us. So I just sent them a rough copy, and I didn't really expect much. And then suddenly, about a month later, a contract came in the mail, and they said, we want to get a contract on this. We really like it. So we agreed to some revisions. By its very nature, the dissertation was, you know, very narrowly academic. It had this long, drawn-out introduction that went on for 50 pages and then a big, long list of letters that I had put together. And that just wouldn't work. So we needed to revise it and rearrange it and do all those things. So I worked on it diligently for a year, and I rearranged everything, and I thought it in pristine condition, and I sent it back, and she sent it back. She said, you have this documented in MLA style, and we need it in Chicago style. So I thought, oh, what do I do? I don't know Chicago style. So I went and bought the book. Have any of you seen the book? The 15th edition of How to Document in Chicago. I was totally lost. But luckily for me, Laura Julier, who is also a professor in RAC, said, well, why don't we set up a project with some of my advanced students to work with you on this project of switching the documentation style. So we did, and it worked out very well. After that, it was just a matter of sort of putting the nuts and bolts together and doing a final edit and a proofreading. And Susan came to my house one day and graciously read through parts of the manuscript and gave me ideas. And you'd be surprised how helpful that is to have your colleagues and people who know you to look over your work and to see what you can do to improve the manuscripts, which is what we did that day, and that was fabulous. So I sent it back. They were happy. It was all going forward. And then this past summer, when I thought it was going to press, I get a phone call in June, and they said, well, we need your index. I hadn't built an index to the manuscript. So a note to those of you who are thinking of doing this, build your index along with your manuscript, because it was a real flurry of activity. I have to say my daughter helped me proofread the index and everything at the last minute. We were in there matching page numbers to words. It was amazing. But so it went on to press in August, and here we have, I just got this in the mail day before yesterday. So it's actually in print, and I couldn't be more happy. So that's my story of the stories. Thank you.
Okay, I'm Heather Howard, and I'm going to talk about the volume that Susan and I edited called Keeping the Campfires Going, Native Women's Activism in Urban Communities, which looks like this. Susan Lobo is passing out an image of an alternative proposed cover for the book that I'll talk about in a moment. Another thing I do want to lead off with talking about, though, is a little bit about the process of how the book came into being and hopefully impart some of the things that I learned along the process. And I know that Susan Lobo will speak a little bit to these things, but I think I probably go back to 1996 when I first met Susan Lobo at the first meetings I ever attended of the American Anthropological Association, which were in San Francisco. And like a good graduate student at the time, I searched the program for people who did research similar to my own. I was doing my dissertation about the Native community in Toronto, and in particular association with this Native Canadian Center, a social service delivery agency that is the oldest organization, Native organization in the city, and had put together a community history project based on the archives of documents that have been accumulated by this agency in the community over its 40-some-odd years of existence. And so looking through the program, I saw Susan Lobo's work, and it was quite amazing how much there were similarities between her experience with the Oakland Indian Friendship Center and the history project that she worked on there. And so like a good graduate student, I got my courage together and attended her talk and went up after the talk to introduce myself. And from there began an important network, I think, that ultimately ended up in the pages of this book. In 2000, I went to the AAA, I don't remember what city it was in, but...
New Orleans.
Was that New Orleans?
Oh, okay.
And scanned the program and found Susan Applegate Krauss talking about the Milwaukee community. And often what happened was we would be kind of lone presenters on these panels, it was never necessarily a panel on urban Indian communities or on Native women's urban activism or any such thing. And so introduced myself to Susan, and within a year we had organized another panel for the American Anthropological Association, that time in Washington, I believe, 2001, and we brought together both colleagues that we had met over the course of doing this kind of typical academic networking, and people who were not necessarily able to come to the conference as well ended up being able to contribute chapters to the book. And so we first planned it as a special issue of American Indian Quarterly, and I think we had seven chapters or something like that in that special issue of American Indian Quarterly, and I think that is a bit of a different process than going directly to an edited volume. This is actually the fourth edited volume that I've done, which is definitely overkill. I would not recommend that for any other graduate students to engage in, but I think part of why I love doing this kind of work is that it enables you to really benefit from mentoring relationships with senior colleagues, senior people who have done a lot of work in the field before us. So I think, for instance, of Joan Weibel Orlando, who was a contributor to the original panel as our discussant, and who wrote another special chapter for this version of the book now that has just come out, had written the introduction to the American Indian Quarterly special issue as well. And also creates tremendous opportunities for collaboration. Turns out that part of this book is why I ended up here at Michigan State University, because Susan took the opportunity to invite me here when I was nearing the end of my dissertation to come here as a visiting scholar, away from Toronto and get away from all of my involvement there so I could focus on getting my work done. But it also gave us an opportunity to work really closely together on putting together the journal and eventually over time putting together this book. And so I really wanted to pay homage to the mentors and the collaborations that come out of these kinds of projects. And just topically, I think the issues that is discussed in this book on recognizing the tremendous roles of Native American women in organizing in urban communities really brought together this kind of fluid networking that was going on behind the scenes, involving scholars from both the United States and Canada. There are a lot of kinds of specific editorial choices, I think, many kinds of editorial choices that are specific to American Indian Studies publishing that came up in our many discussions about as we put the book together. And one in particular you see circulating there, this photograph that was the original proposed cover from the University of Nebraska Press for the book. And I, as you know, as you can see, that's not how the book turned out. This is how the book turned out instead. And I just wonder if anybody in the audience has some ideas on what's wrong with that picture.
If, I was struck by the fact that there's two INGs in the title that didn't liven it up for me, but maybe that's still the case on the...
Well, the title's the same. I think we're speaking specifically about the photograph itself.
Okay.
Okay, there's a man in the picture, yes, and actually there are very few men in our book, but there are some men who do make appearances in our book. And so that was an important factor. Anything else that kind of strikes you as unusual about this picture as a suggested cover art for a book on this topic? What's that? That's not really what urban communities look like. That's a very good comment. And it really, you know, is the beginning of part of a number of issues that Susan and I had when we saw this image. But I think the key thing, I know that disturbed me, I know Susan might have some other things to add to this, but to me the most disturbing thing was that there are anonymous people with their backs to the camera. We don't know who they are. And yes, it's out of context. It looks like it's Washington, D.C., which is probably the furthest removed kind of focus for urban American Indian experience because that's the center of power for people who live on reservations and federally recognized tribes, and that doesn't often correlate with the people who live in urban centers. But I think that it might have been difficult to get a... Now, at this point, Gary Dunham had left, and we were dealing with some new people at the University of Nebraska Press, and they have made a lot of changes, I think, in how they decide cover art and so on. Clearly, I don't know if they... Susan suggested maybe they keyworded urban and Indians or something, and so they got a picture of two people standing in a city. But we had to really carefully craft our objections to this image, and... one of the things that we talked about was the fact that when you work in American Indian communities, it's very possible that when we're at powwows or something like that, that someone might come up to us and actually say, how come I'm on the cover of your book and I'm not identified? Or how come that's my aunt and uncle on the cover of your book? What did they have to do with your book? And I don't think the press would have bought that kind of objection on our part. So we just kind of crafted a very simple email that basically said we didn't really like the image, that we felt it didn't fit, and could we have something else. But we really had a lot of objections to the picture on a number of levels that I think really reflects some of the important kinds of specific things that you need to pay attention to in the publishing and editorial process specific to American Indian Studies. And so I think I'll end there on that point. Thank you.
Since Heather was just talking about covers, I just wanted to put a little footnote, because we talked about this yesterday, actually, and I've done a number of books, so you just kind of learn bit by bit what's going to facilitate the process so that you get the book that you envision. Because when I'm doing a book, I really do have a vision of what I want it to look like physically, you know? So I usually now put into the contract, and a part of the the process is negotiating your contract. And many people just don't negotiate the contract. I'm going to segue. The first book I published, which was my dissertation, I remember I went to the University of Arizona Press, where I'd gotten my degree, and we talked, we negotiated, and they looked at it, and then it went on for quite a while, and then they said, yes, we'd like to publish it. I remember I was sitting at this big table, and the principal editor was sitting there, and he said, I have the contract here, and I was so excited. You know, he slid the contract across the table to me. I didn't even read it. I said, where do I sign? Where do I sign? And, you know, like 40 pages down, he said, oh, right here in the back. I signed it, and I slid it back, and I was like, oh, wonderful. And a few days later, I went home, and my hair stood on end because I realized all the things I was expected to do. And since that time, with other books, I now negotiate my contracts very carefully. And one of the things I always put in is I will supply the illustration for the cover, and I will have rights of refusal for any way they design the cover. I mean, with this book, they designed it very poorly. This was a picture that I provided, and I said, I don't like it, and it's in my contract. I can refuse it. And they said, well, we didn't like it very much either. So they did, they redesigned it very nicely. And I've had three books published with the U of A Press, and so now they know that I like to work with them on the look of the book. I just think it's very, very important. And for some authors, this really isn't vital at all. But for me, it is. I love books. I love to be engaged in that process of holding a book and feeling it and reading it. And I hope that the people that read my books also will have that kind of response. So this question of the cover, I now put that in a contract. You know, I'm very sure that I say, you know, I want to have control of what goes on that cover to some extent. And some publishers don't want you to be, involved in that. But what I had intended to talk about a little bit is this question that that Heather brought up about kind of the development of collegial relationships and how this is so important as ideas and themes for books develop, and that interchange that happens that makes the ideas flow, the creative ideas flow, the research enriches the research, and it also helps in the implementation of the actual publishing. Because there is a point, I think in graduate school, there's a lot of talk about theory, about research, and then there's a stop in the discussion. And it's, okay, and then you see if you can get a publication. But all that process, like the years, like all of us, we know these books take years sometimes from when you finish the research, you have a manuscript that you think is okay, maybe not perfect, but it may be years that you're looking for a publisher, that you're then working with a publisher to get that book before it comes out. So that whole process usually isn't addressed in graduate school. So a lot of people, like me, you know, the idea that you get your dissertation is going to be published, it's just so wonderful. You sign that contract before you even think what all the steps are. And it's a, sort of the slow learning process over the years as you realize, I don't have to do the index. I can negotiate that in my contract that, yes, I'll sign it, but you do the index. And, yes, I have control of the cover. And I will give you names and we'll work together in terms of who's going to write the blurbs on the back. This is really important. Those blurbs that say, this is the best book that was ever written, you know. You want that kind of thing on the back by different people that are renowned. And so I put in my contracts that I will work with you. We will work in conjunction and collaboration to determine who the blurb reviewers are. Now, they're the reviewers that a review press. Some presses just publish. But academic presses, they'll send the books out for review, as we've all been discussing. And So they these are our secret reviewers. In fact, I don't even know who reviewers are. I've been on my books. Well, sometimes you find out, but or someone will say, "Hey, by the way, that book that you wrote 5 years ago, I was one of the reviewers." But then there's another process when it moves from production, what's called production. You learn about this whole publishing. It goes through editorial, then it's into production, and then it goes into the marketing. And some small presses, essentially the same two or three set of people. And this new book of mine, this one, is Prentice Hall. It's the third edition of this book. I've been working with the same acquiring editor since the 90s. And this one just came out a few weeks ago. And, I mean, it's an enormous company, enormous. I have lists on the walls of all the different people that I would contact. And, in fact, they even subcontracted portions of it to India. And there were all these people in India I was dealing with, which was not a good process at all for me. So there is a point when it moves to marketing. And that's when your contract wants to kick in to say, I will be involved in working with you to select the people that write the blurbs. It's a whole terminology. And then they send the manuscript out to certain people that you've suggested. In fact, you may have even contacted them and said, are you interested to write a blurb? Can I give your name? And they send them the manuscript, and then that person hopefully will write something glowing about your book. And, of course, you choose people who write well, too, not only have nice ideas or may like the book and know about the topic and will be names that others recognize. These are just little things you learn. But in graduate school, I don't think that there's much discussion about the actual publishing process. It's something that you just kind of feel your way, which is a shame. There could be a good seminar on how this happens. But it is very interesting how there is kind of an evolution, or there's been an evolution in our relationship in terms of the urban topics. I did my dissertation years ago, over 35 years ago, in Peru, and I was very interested in migrants to the city, Quechua people who migrated to the city and were living in shantytowns, and they were indigenous people. So I became interested in native people and cities and migration, urban migration. Then I started to do more work in the United States and was living in Oakland, and there were personal reasons why I couldn't travel overseas. So I started working with native people who'd migrated to Oakland, and in other words, urban Indians. And there were very, very few. There wasn't much literature at all on the topic of urban Indians. Even today, if you go into a bookstore or library and you say, I'd like to see what work you have on urban topics, native topics in urban areas, and usually there are maybe one or two. I became very interested in this whole process and why it was that there was so little literature. And I was working at the Indian Center at that time. We developed an archive, the shock that Heather and I had, we had no idea that for a number of years we both, independent of one another, had been working at Indian centers. I was in Oakland, she was in Toronto, and we met at that AAA meeting, and she was doing essentially, our work was so parallel in that we were working at the Indian centers doing and developing an oral history, photographic, an archive that documented the native community in our cities. And I had checked all around the United States. It didn't seem like anyone else was doing the kind of work I was doing. I failed to check in Canada. And then this was kind of a wonderful spark that happened, and we realized, there are other colleagues out there that have an interest in urban as well. I had often felt I'm the only person around that has this interest. I mean, there were others, but very few and far between. And so we started to really communicate quite a bit and inspire one another. This was a book that went on for years and years, but it came out. U of A Press came out in 2003, I think. But we always laugh because it was a very collaborative book based on oral histories and photographs from the Community History Project, we called it. But we always laugh that it took us 20 years to do this book. which is when we started doing the oral histories. Not to get it published, but it took 20 years. And then I just want to mention the spinoff came that more and more people that we were meeting, in fact, from the panel that was at AAA in the mid-90s, I then co-edited a special issue on urban experience. That was a special issue with the American Indian Culture and Research Journal that comes out of UCLA. And from that special issue, then the idea was, well, let's see if we can do a book. And so eventually this book came out. It's called American Indians and the Urban Experience. And this is a whole other story, too, as to how this came about. And I have on the back here a list of all the contributors. So more and more people with urban interests, you know, I was contacting these people. And at that time, when this came out, it was essentially, well, there had been some works in the 70s that had a different kind of focus. But this came out in 2001. And at that time, it was probably the fullest compilation of contemporary research on urban American Indian topics. And it was such a pleasure to contact. Some of these are artists, some of them are photographers, some of them are poets and so forth, and some of them are academic writers, and some of them are less academic writers, but good writers of some sort. And it was such a pleasure to pull this book together with a strong urban topic. So I think it was kind of as Heather and Susan describe wonderfully in this dissertation. I mean, in this book, which is like a dissertation, in their introduction, they describe the history and of the urban studies. And so I think this is another plateau. I think this was a collection that was a plateau 8 years ago. This is another plateau because it focuses women, but it's a continuation of the theme that we started of really looking carefully at urban topics. And, of course, that's of women, whereas this other one was much more general. This is an oral history one. And just another kind of spin-off of all of this, this is the third edition of this book that I co-edit with Steve Talbot and Tracy Morris. And it just came out a few weeks ago. And with this one, I decided to put, there are nine chapters, or parts. I decided to make one part that was urban only, urban. And so, once again, either I pulled from existing things or I contacted people. I asked Heather if she had a piece she'd like to put in this book. So, once again, you know, our thinking is intertwined and is cross-fertilizing one another in a lot of different ways. One more book. I had two books come out almost at the same time. This is oral history. It really doesn't have too much to do about urban. It's an art book. It's a totally different kind of book. It's based on the life of a Tonawatam artist. And so I think in the same way that we all have these ideas as creative and scholarly people, we also inspire one another as we meet and make exchanges. And this all gets woven together so that these books are in a way, these are a family of books, I always think of them, because over the years we've interacted so much and exchanged ideas and encouraged each other onward. And even though we all have different approaches and different styles, I think, you know, these and the other books that aren't here today, it's kind of like a family of books. I had a lot of other topics, but I think the time is running out.
There's
some questions. Well, so we'll go to questions. But thank you so much. I really, it's a pleasure and honor to be here. It was kind of coincidental. I was passing through the region, and I got nabbed for this thing. So thanks a lot.
we'd be happy to entertain questions, and if you have some, and yes, please.
When you're writing the book, you get to choose who can write the foreword, if there's going to be a foreword introduction.
The question is, when you're writing the book, do you get to choose who might write the foreword or the introduction? I think I'll turn that over to somebody who has a foreword or an introduction. Yeah. Kim?
I have a foreword. I was asked to supply some names, and then they decided at the press who would write the foreword. And as it turned out, it was my editor, John Wonder, who wrote the foreword. I was also asked if I could supply names for people who would write blurbs on the back. And I supplied some names, none of which appeared. But that's okay. They got Helen Winterstoffer, who was Sandoz's biographer, to write a blurb. And so that was fine. And the rest, I'm assuming an editor wrote, you know, to sort of talk about the book. But Mari herself always said that... she didn't want anybody else to write the foreword or the introduction, that she had enough to say, and that it was her book, and that she would always write her own. But I didn't have that. I didn't follow in her footsteps on that. So sometimes I think yes, and sometimes that might just depend on the press you're working with.
Other questions? Way in the back. The question was, were some of your beliefs challenged during the editing process? And what do we think?
Well, I might just say that I don't think that my beliefs or my research was compromised in my case, but there are... things that happen along the way. For instance, we have contributors who may not be able to finish their contribution and eventually have to drop out. And, you know, we spend a lot of time kind of lamenting about how far do we go with really encouraging this person. And I think especially, again, because it's American Indian Studies, if we have American Indian colleagues, we want to especially encourage them through the process. We may end up in a lot of delays because of those things that feel like things are compromised, and ultimately if someone drops out and it's not part of the full picture in the end, there is a sense of loss in that sense, I think, in my experience with editing these volumes, because it just kind of happens that people may not necessarily be able to complete the work for various reasons. It can happen also that maybe some of our contributors end up submitting something finally that doesn't really fit with the overall picture of the book, and you kind of have to think about who do you exclude from the book and why. And it's not always because it's a bad chapter. It just may not fit with your overall vision for an edited collection. One of the things we wanted to do at first was have this coverage geographically from, you know, coast to coast, north to south. And it just wasn't possible. We solicited some chapters from, for instance, people in our network from New York and Boston, Winnipeg, and for various reasons those things didn't happen or come together in the book, and we kind of had to speak to this issue in our introduction that ultimately the book is not about covering everything geographically, but trying to convey some common themes that come across in the chapters that are in the book.
And certainly in the process of working with these presses, it is a negotiation at almost every step, not just the contract, although that is very important. But, for example, when Nebraska asked me to make some changes, I agreed to some of them, and some of them I did not agree to. And what you write is a response, the author's response to the editorial board. And you either say, yes, I will do this, and I will do it in the following way, or no, I will not do this, and here are the reasons why, and here's my time frame for for making these adjustments. So there is this constant negotiation, really up until it's finally shipped. It really is until the very last moment. Everything from pages and covers and the sort of format of it to the actual content. Yes.
It sounds like it's an arduous years and experience. But what is your response to having that published book in your
hand? The question was, it's an arduous process, but what is your response to holding a book? It's really good.
Yeah. Is it worth it?
Oh, God, yes. It's fabulous. I don't want to, I'm sure everybody has something.
I just wanted to say, too, well, I mean, to me, the physicalness of the book is so nice, you know, and I was so pleased. It turns out this book, which is an art book, they printed it in South Korea, which is doing some wonderful printing. The paper is just slick and beautiful, you know, and it feels so, it really is nice. But I think even more than the way the book itself feels is when you get responses, when you're talking to a group and someone, or just you get an email from someone, and they'll pick up on something, they'll say, reminds me something in my life, or I know some of the people in the book. This was my aunt, or this is my cousin. I didn't realize this person was around there. I haven't seen any of the photography taken by this wonderful photographer in so long, and I just loved it. So getting those responses back, because, you know, it's just like this book, and you're sending it across this dark water, and it's out there, and, you know, and you send it out there, and if you never hear, I mean, you may months go by, and you're, gee, I wonder if anybody read this. But then you start getting some responses back, and that's what really is just like, okay, it's worth it. Even one wonderful response. Yeah.
I have a question sort of related to that. Since some of the books seem more geared towards academic audiences and some are more general, I guess I was wondering how you try and tailor your writing, because you're working with American Indian communities and you want this information to get back to the community members too. How do you balance that when you're writing these books, and does it work? Does the information get back to the communities the way you want it to?
The question is about audience and whether the books that, many of which are academic books, whether those get back to the American Indian communities in which we work.
Let me just quickly say, since this book came out, I had an experience I never thought I'd experience in my whole life. Leonard Chana, this is his it's autobiographical in a sense, was beloved. He passed away while we were working on the book. So when the book came out, at the end of August, the Tana Atam Community Center and Museum had a book celebration, and I got in my car, I drove out there on the reservation, and I thought there'd be 50, 60, 70 people there. Well, the tribe had just pulled out the stops. They had kids from the elementary school dancing. They had a Waila band, it's the kind like here, music. They had food. When I got there, the parking lot was filled with people. There were hundreds and hundreds hundreds of people. U of A, I was just stunned. I had never thought a book would be of such interest. But they all knew Leonard, which is why, you know, they were waiting. And the U of A press was there, and they had their table plot piled high with books. Barbara Chana, my co-author on this, Leonard's widow, we signed books continuously for 2.5 hours. And the press said they sold over 400 books in, you know, 3 hours or so. And so talk about getting back to the community. Yeah. Sometimes it happens in ways that you just cannot envision. But this is a much more general reader book, which I hadn't really, I mean, I do these more academic things generally. So, yeah, and then little things come in the mail.
But it never ceases to amaze me. As an academic, you write things, even in scholarly journals, and sure enough, somebody will stop you at a powwow and say, I read that article, and I want to talk to you about that. So it is especially gratifying when you connect with somebody whose family is represented in your work, whose community is represented, because that's why we're all in American Indian Studies. We all participate in Native communities. And that maybe is different from some other authors, that we feel this responsibility to the communities in which we work and live. But that, to me, is the best, when somebody says, my grandfather is in your book.
That is good. I don't know what my response might be. I'm hoping it'll get back to the community. Actually, there's a lot of letters in here that Sandoz wrote to tribal members. She also had a long-standing relationship with Brummett Echo Hawk, who in his young days, and when he was not well-known, but he was a struggling illustrator and artist, Mari had him do some illustrations for an article that she wrote. And then they struck up a real good friendship. And they visited back and forth and back and forth. And then Brummett went on to become an internationally known artist. And actually he published a book called Young Writer of the High Plains near the end of his life. He just passed away, I think, a year or two ago. But I'm hoping that some of his relatives will, you know that she wrote letters to him, and then what good friends they were back in the early 60s when she was really encouraging him to go ahead and write and paint and do those things. So, but I don't know. It hasn't been out there long enough to know. So we'll see what happens.
Well, I'm thinking that we might continue this conversation over some food.
Yes.
So thank you all very much for your kind attention. And let's go eat.